Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was working in a coffee shop in Boston to like help pay rent while I was training for the trials. And so people kept joking. They're like, oh, yeah, she just took a 2-hour coffee break and went and ran the Olympic trials marathon.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their journeys to the top. On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 17th of August, these are our main stories. West African military chiefs have met to discuss possible armed intervention in Niger following last month's coup. The capital of Canada's Northwest Territories is being evacuated in the face of an approaching wildfire. Pakistani authorities have banned public gatherings in the city of Jaranwala after at least four churches were burned by Muslim crowds. Also in this podcast, the first sports teams to leave North Korea since the COVID pandemic, and
an individual mushroom is beautiful, and a bunch of these growing together, or if lots of them, it would be quite magical.
Why do mushrooms glow green in the dark? We are still giving diplomacy a chance, but if that fails, our forces are ready to go into Niger. That's the head of the regional security bloc, ECOWAS, making it quite clear that the new military leaders in Niger will not get away with last month's coup. The Commissioner for Peace and Security, Abdel Fattah Moussa, warned the junta would be held to account for their actions.
The ball is in the court of the junta, the CNSP, in Niger. If they pull back from the brink, the military option will not be necessary. But we want to warn them that all options are on the table and no option is off the table.
Our correspondent Thomas Nardi is in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
We are gradually getting closer to an armed intervention. Speaker after speaker at this particular conference emphasized the fact that they are determined to restore constitutional rule in Niger. And they've said that everything is ready. They are just firming up their strategy as to when and how to possibly enter Niger.
So we know that ECOWAS is split over this, but you're saying that it could well be that just a certain portion of ECOWAS goes in with their troops.
Yeah, it's just a few ECOWAS member countries who are unwilling to be part of this. But the majority of members of the bloc are supporting this and they are contributing troops. We know that Burkina Faso, Mali and Guinea have opposed the invasion. We also know that they are under military rule. And of course, they are no longer part. They've been banned from the organization. And then one other tiny African country is not willing to take part in this. But quite apart from that, all member countries are ready and willing to contribute troops for this particular invasion. In most of these countries and places like Ghana, for instance, there's ongoing debate as to whether Ghanaian soldiers should take part in this.
Okay, well, we're not there yet, are we? So they're saying, we just heard them say there, that there's a diplomacy to be played out. What's the likely reaction from Niger, the leaders there?
Well, the diplomacy appears to be faltering. Now, the junta in Niger is a beginning to give diplomacy a chance. He's made it official. The newly elected prime minister has said that they are in a transition period and they will welcome negotiations or diplomatic officials into the country. But we know that previously they've rejected this. So why now? And it's most likely because of the threat of the use of force in Niger.
Thomas Nardi there. Get out of town before the weekend. That is the message given to the 20,000 residents of Yellowknife, one of the largest cities in Canada's far north, who've been told that they're in the direct path of fires that are burning out of control. Well, the major issue is that there's only one road out, and that is through the fires. In the middle of the night in Canada, Bob Zimmer, the shadow minister for the region, urged families to get to safety.
If you're in Yellowknife, I've actually been speaking to some locals about the situation. and we want you to be safe. Make sure you take care of your families and get them to safety. We'll be watching the situation closely, but most of all, be safe out there.
So, a real sense of urgency now. Our reporter Stephanie Prentice gave me an update.
It is dramatic and it is a fast-moving situation. We know that order to leave Yellowknife was given out Wednesday evening, telling residents living close to the fires, that's in the west, in no uncertain terms, to evacuate immediately, and giving Friday at noon as the last possible time the whole community may be able to get out safely. Now, this is because those fires that have been burning up north and close to Yellowknife, they've been more ferocious than authorities had been expecting. And natural and man-made fire breaks aren't doing anything. They're just going over them, going through them. So for those families who are now grabbing their belongings, packing up their homes, potentially saying goodbye to those homes forever, there is that other obstacle you mentioned. There are two clear paths out of this situation. One is a flight. The other is a highway, and that highway runs through the main fire that's burning. So the advice that's being given is the road is closing intermittently. The advice is just get out when you can. Jets are also being deployed alongside commercial flights. That's to get people out that are vulnerable, that are older, that can't flee and might be unable generally to escape.
And this is, I suppose, the most dramatic of a number of different wildfires that have been raging, I don't know, for several months now. I remember a few months ago we were talking about the first of these in Nova Scotia out east. It's been a particularly severe season for fires, hasn't it?
Yes, we know that Canada has an annual wildfire season, but this is being described as its worst. And that's because these fires are wilder, they're harder to get under control, they're moving closer to communities and infrastructure than expected. And officials are saying they're moving unpredictably at greater speeds. And that's why, for safety, they want every single resident out. Now, recent estimates do say that around 1,000 fires are burning in the country, and Yellowknife is the ninth NWT, Northwest Territory, to get that evacuation order. And quickly, for context, another of those communities, it's called Hay River, they were told to evacuate last week. Residents told stories of driving through embers, their vehicles melting around them, windows cracking through heat, and of driving through that dense orange haze we've been seeing in Canada recently. So these stories of fleeing and how hard it can be show what could happen to those Yellowknife residents, even if they leave within that safe evacuation window.
Stephanie Prentice. Let's stay with devastating wildfires now, because President Biden says that he's going to travel to Hawaii next week to inspect the places affected on Maui. He's been criticised by his political opponents, who said that he's been too slow to see the devastation for himself. So far, officials have confirmed that more than 100 people have died in the fires. Josh Green is the governor of Hawaii.
We're just a little bit more heartbroken because we do have to report that more of our loved ones have been confirmed lost and deceased. 110 individuals have been confirmed deceased. We'll get some details about this from our distinguished leaders in police and fire. 38% of the territory has been covered.
Lance is a resident of the worst affected town, Lahaina, and he spoke to my colleague Victoria Wankunda about what happened to him and his family the day fire swept through his hometown. After fleeing, he saw his house on the news engulfed in flames.
I wish I had taken more. If I could go back and you give me 30 seconds, I can take so much more things that I value. Just the pictures, the memories of my children, my like important documents that I left at home. I'm a prior military. I was in the Air Force for 6 years. I got a newborn on the way. I just wish I had taken all the supplies that we had been piling up in his nursery, a lot of things that we had bought prior, waiting for his arrival. And, you know, everything is kind of gone. But I just wish I had taken more from my kids and my family. That's all.
How is it fleeing your home, seeing your home go up in flames when you have a wife who is expecting?
It's terrifying. When I finally left the house, it wasn't on fire yet, but I could see the fire across the highway of the street above our house. It was kind of like a realization. It was so close. I've never seen fire this close before. I had to make sure that they left for safety. You know, we just wanted them, everyone, to get to safety, like the women and children. And then the evacuation center had to get evacuated because the fire was so close to that area, you know. That's how fast it moves. Sorry, I'm just trying to compose myself.
Take your time.
You know, we're fortunate we got a big family, a lot of people that care about us, but there's so much people out there missing, lost. Us, you know, they don't have their loved ones. People I know, people that are in my life, we're one of the lucky ones. You know, I was running down Front Street. I actually, when they evacuated the first time, my family, we parked our cars, and me and my brother were kind of like, we have to go home to get our dogs. So we drove back. We were driving back with a wall of orange surrounding us. And when we got to the north ending of Front Street, we just realized how bad everything had gotten, and the flames were already on, lighting up houses on that end of Front Street. It jumped the road already at this point. I just looked at him. I said, you know, we got to start running. And so we ran from that beach park to my house. It's maybe a quarter of a mile. Running down Front Street, I passed by houses of people I know. Tigre, he's a chef that I used to work at Mall of Ocean Tavern with. I saw his house in flames. I saw one of our family friends' house in flames. Auntie Kim, her house was on fire. And I just cried. I just cried as we ran. It was so hard to process. We got there, and as soon as I passed my mailbox, I was screaming for my dogs. And sure enough, they came out. You know, they were waiting. They didn't go anywhere. Just, it's all a blur. It was, you look in the rear view and it's the sky is just lit up in red and orange. It was so terrifying. It's never going to be the same. I want it back. I need to go back there. I want Lahaina back.
That was Lance, a resident of Maui there. Now to Pakistan, where we've been bringing you news of the terrible violence after two Christian men were accused of desecrating pages of the Quran. Well, the police are now guarding a Christian neighbourhood in the province of Punjab after hundreds of Muslim men attacked the area. The violence broke out in the city of Jaranwala and five churches were torched. The Most Reverend Dr. Azad Marshall is president of Pakistan's National Council of Churches. And he told the BBC that these mobs were intent on stoking unrest.
It's very sad and shocking because Christian community is a peaceful community. And they're minding their own business, and they are not the ones who will commit crimes like desecrating the Quran. There is no real clear evidence. I believe it is really made-up claim and just to create disturbance.
Well, all public gatherings in Jaranwala have now been banned for 7 days. Our correspondent Caroline Davies is at the scene of the attacks.
We're in the Christian quarter of Jaranwala, and you can see the level of destruction. All of these items are things that have been taken from inside the homes of Christians in this community, brought outside and burnt. That's according to what the authorities have told us, that there are fans, there are chairs, there are beds, fridges, any items that people could get hold of. Now, we understand that this is all a reaction because there were accusations that two Christian men had damaged the Quran, had torn pages and desecrated the Quran, and that this was a response. People gathered together in anger and then came out. And we've talked to people who are from some of the homes nearby talking about the fear when they started hearing of people coming towards them, of attacks imminent, that they gathered their children together and then ran away as quickly as possible. St. John's Church, which is a Catholic church, the walls are completely blackened from the smoke and from the items that were burnt here. All that is left inside is there are the remains of the altar, a few tables that have been blackened as well. But this is just one part of the devastation. We know that there have been at least four churches that have been damaged. Now, according to the authorities, they've arrested over 100 people because of this damage, in relation to this damage. But we know that the two individuals, the two Christians that have been accused of having desecrated the Quran, have so far not been arrested.
Caroline Davis. Two green buses have been spotted crossing the river that divides North Korea and China. A small event, maybe, but a huge moment for the country in its journey with the coronavirus. On board are believed to have been members of a North Korean taekwondo team on their way to a competition. Well, Pyongyang sealed itself off from all trade and diplomatic ties in early 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The BBC's Michael Bristow told me more about this taekwondo team.
North Korea doesn't give official announcements often on all kinds of things, but this team have been observed, as you mentioned there, crossing the border to Dandong, which is a city on the border with North Korea, a Chinese city. They then got on a train, an overnight train, and went to Beijing, where they were again spotted travelling on buses which belonged to the North Korean embassy. It's assumed that this is a taekwondo team on their way to Astana, which is the capital of Kazakhstan, where there's international world taekwondo championships taking place this weekend. So that's what we know. And as you indicated there in your introduction, it's a sign that after strict COVID restrictions being sealed off from the rest of the world, North Korea is slowly opening up.
Michael, I understand that cross-border freight trains between North Korea and China started again last year. So goods have been coming in and getting out of the country, particularly food, because there was a real concern, wasn't there, during the pandemic, that there was sort of starvation and real lack of food during the pandemic and real problems there. What is the overall situation now in terms of North Korea's attitude to the pandemic and COVID? How is it dealing with it?
Well, no country in the world closed itself off quite as much as North Korea's did. As you indicated there, trains between China and North Korea resumed last year, and slowly they're opening up. Earlier, just to give you an example of how closed off it was, North Korea's biggest ally, China, didn't even have its ambassador in North Korea until March this year. The North Koreans gave the Chinese special dispensation to send their ambassador. So that gives you an example of the greatest ally can't get its ambassador in. That shows you how closed off it was. Last month, there was a parade to mark the end of the fighting in the Korean War, and a Chinese and a Russian delegation went there. So that's another indication that it's opening up. This taekwondo team is yet another signal. So North Korea will open up slowly, and that will only help the economy and help the country reintegrate to a certain extent with the international community.
Michael Bristow. Still to come in this podcast.
She lined us up in front of the class and hit our palms with a plastic ruler one by one.
Why some in South Korea still want to see teachers fight back.
What in the World is the podcast exploring the stories and the issues that you need to know about.
93% of fast fashion workers aren't getting paid a living wage.
The former president is accused of trying to overturn democracy.
How do elite athletes train in and around their menstrual cycle?
Understand more, feel better with What in the World from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
Welcome back. It is the stuff of heist films and best-selling fiction, the theft of priceless jewellery from the British Museum in London. We gave you details in our earlier podcast of the robbery of items, including gemstones dating back to 1500 BC from the museum's vaults. A member of staff has been arrested. Well, George Osborne, chairman of the museum, said the theft, which was discovered earlier this year, was a sad day for all who love our British Museum. And the staff would do whatever it takes to improve security. Christopher Marinello is a lawyer and founder of Art Recovery International, specialising in recovering stolen art and artefacts. He spoke to Simon Jack.
Well, it happens every single day around the world. What's shocking is that it's happened to the British Museum, one of the most important and well-funded museums in the world.
Would they put out feelers to somebody like you and say, keep your eyes peeled for various stolen artifacts?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, historically, we have been notified once there is a list of objects that have been stolen. That should be the priority at this point, is preparing an inventory and comparing it with a previous inventory to find out what exactly is missing, and then get those objects listed on various databases, private, public, Interpol, so that the art market could start searching for these objects.
Because is there, I mean, what kind of a market is there for stolen artifacts like this? I would have thought that once the word is out and you've got this inventory that you say, it'd be very difficult to move on. Or are there private collectors who have got no scruples about this?
Well, we're talking about the art world, and that's something where scruples is hard to come by. We have very reputable auction houses that will do due diligence, that will hold objects that they know are stolen. But then you have a lot of smaller auction houses that are more interested in earning commissions and get frustrated when someone reports something as stolen in their sale room and they just hand it back to the person who brought it in. And then you have disreputable dealers who will handle anything to make a profit. And, so there is also the black market, which will sell anything at a severe discount to collectors and dealers who do no due diligence and really don't care.
That was Christopher Marinello there. Let's head to Zimbabwe now, where people will soon take part in a presidential election. It will be the second since Robert Mugabe was ousted by the military 6 years ago. And when he left, hopes were high that his successor, Emmerson Mnangagwa, might rebuild the failing economy and commit to democratic principles. And those hopes, after President Mugabe was ejected, have all but vanished, and skilled workers are leaving in their thousands. Charlotte Ashton reports now from the capital, Harare. Everyone she spoke to asked us not to use their real names.
That's the street where money changers are from this corner. All these guys. It's exchanging foreign currency.
Exchanging foreign currency.
Yeah. They're buying and selling.
Yeah.
Taxi driver Dixon is taking us on a tour of downtown Harare. The streets are lined with money changers, swapping Zimbabwe dollars for US dollars.
Because the US dollars will retain their value and the Zimbabwe dollar is not.
It's not. And there's no way you can keep Zimbabwe dollars now at home, in banks or even at home. Because it's losing value nearly every day.
The local currency has rapidly devalued in the last 5 years, driving a black market for US dollars. Street vendors selling other things are everywhere too. And on Third Avenue, there are sex workers.
Look at the girls from the right side.
Young girl in a
young girl
short dress there. Big eyelashes, fake eyelashes and dyed hair.
Yeah, all the way down there.
And has the number of sex workers on this street increased in recent times?
It has increased. This it would be full, this street. Because this is not good at all.
The last 12 months have seen outbreaks of typhoid and cholera as water and sewage systems deteriorate. About a third of Zimbabweans are food insecure, and a quarter of children under five are chronically malnourished. All this is driving an exodus of skilled workers. The UK is one of the top destinations. In 2020, the British government issued 1,000 skilled worker visas to Zimbabweans. Last year, that had risen to more than 23,000.
The main decision I made to come to the UK was based on finding stable and solid ground to be able to have a guaranteed salary every month, despite the type of work that I'm doing that is worlds apart from what I went to school to study.
Rose has a master's degree, but moved to the UK last year for a care worker job in the Midlands. She lives in shared accommodation, but the biggest sacrifice she's made is leaving behind her 9-year-old daughter. Rose's hope is to bring her daughter to the UK for secondary school, because Zimbabwe's education system, once famed as the best in Africa, is collapsing.
Gosh, this is very neat handwriting. What homework are you doing this evening?
I was writing notes on history because we have exams that are coming up.
So you're teaching yourself, basically?
Yes.
Earlier this year, the British government put Zimbabwe on a list of countries whose teachers can apply for qualified teacher status, allowing them to work long-term in the UK. So the exodus of care workers could become an exodus of the country's educators.
That was Charlotte Ashton, and you can hear more from Charlotte about the current situation in Zimbabwe on this week's edition of Assignment here on the BBC World Service, or search for the documentary wherever you get your podcasts. Teachers in most countries used to be able to physically restrain or even beat the kids in their classrooms. That's been outlawed in most places now. But one nation, South Korea, is at least partially going back to the past. Jae Sung Lee from the BBC's newsroom went to school in South Korea and he told me more about the new rules.
So South Korea's education ministry approved these new powers, which come into force next month, for teachers to discipline their students after protests by teachers over abuse by pupils and parents. Now, under these new laws, teachers will be allowed to remove students from classrooms and confiscate their mobile phones if they cause any disruption in class. Currently, as we've talked about, any form of physical punishment for students is banned. This was after authorities introduced the Ordinance of Student Right Law in 2010, which prohibits these kind of physical punishment in classrooms. But now authorities think that this law has taken too much power from teachers in classroom. And the announcement today follows the death of a 24-year-old elementary school teacher last month who killed herself after allegedly being harassed by parents over a school violence case. And her premature death has sparked a national outcry in South Korea.
I mean, that's clearly appalling. I understand until quite recently, in fact, when you were at school, teachers were allowed to use corporal punishment, weren't they?
Oh, definitely. The mentality was like, spare the rod, spoil the child. Mm-hmm. And parents thought it was actually okay for teachers to discipline their children at school if they misbehaved. This was quite normal. I remember back when I was an elementary school student in the early 2000s, we misbehaved and we unfortunately broke a window in the classroom. And the teacher got really, really angry. And she lined us up all up in front of the class and hit our palms with a plastic ruler one by one. And I remember some of my classmates crying, and, you know, it's not a nice thing. But that was kind of normal back then.
And these new laws aren't going to go back to that kind of thing. But are there some people in South Korea who still feel that would be a good thing to do?
So definitely these new rules means that, you know, teachers will be able to physically restrain those students who misbehave. But I think there is still some sort of mentality in South Korea that feels like if children misbehave, they need to be punished.
That was Jae Sung Lee. People visiting the forests of Goa in southwest India have been treated to a rare scientific spectacle, an unearthly glow coming from the forest floor itself. Having been drenched with rain, mushrooms are glowing in the dark, emitting a bioluminescence which has inspired wonder in people who've been witnessing it for thousands of years. Even Aristotle, it seems, once witnessed it and mused on why it might be happening. Professor Jay Dunlap is from the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth in the US, whose research focuses on bioluminescent fungi. He described it to Simon Jack.
It looks like a mushroom, except that it is making its own light. The light is very dim. So if you were trying to look at it in the daytime, you wouldn't be able to see anything. But at night, when there aren't any, when there's no interference from outside lighting, it's a constant green light coming from the inside of the mushroom. So you can still see the gills underneath. It's all glowing.
And en masse, it must create quite a magical effect.
It's quite magical. If an individual mushroom is beautiful, and a bunch of these growing together, or if they would move off into the distance with lots of them, it would be quite magical.
And what's going on here? What's creating this unearthly light?
It's an enzymatic reaction. There's an enzyme called a luciferase. That's a generic term. I should back up and say that bioluminescence is very widespread in nature. So fungi do it, insects do it, fish do it, bacteria do it. So that's, you know, lots of organisms do it. And they all use an enzyme called a luciferase, although the luciferases are different in different organisms. So this enzyme works on a substrate called a luciferin, and along with molecular oxygen, the luciferase oxidizes the luciferin that makes a high-energy intermediate, and the enzyme holds this oxidized substrate and causes the energy to be emitted as light instead of heat. That's what's going on in the cells of all these fungi.
I'm no linguist, but luciferase, luciferin, that sounds like has its origins in Lucifer.
You're very perceptive, and that is exactly correct.
Do we know why, what sort of function this performs in nature? Do we know what the function of this
Different organisms use bioluminescence for different things. They can use it for communication or for attracting mates or as an epistematic warning that I am poisonous, don't eat me, or I don't taste good, don't eat me. One of the uses is probably in helping fungi get from place to place. The green light is attractive to insects that like to come and eat them. And when they come, they will the insects will be covered with spores, and then they'll carry these spores off into the rest of the forest. And so it's beneficial to the fungi to help them get around.
But and then is this rare? I mean, a sighting like this, a phenomenon like this that we're seeing in Goa in southwest India, is this a kind of once in a lifetime thing for a botanist or someone lucky enough to come across it?
Far from once in a lifetime. Once the mushroom is there, it will continue to turn up when the conditions are right. And if the mushroom is not there, then they will never be there. So I would guess this will be a not infrequent occurrence. It, maybe not annual, but certainly far from rare in the regions where they are seen.
Yeah, I've seen it myself in the sea at the Atlantic occasionally. Is it the same sort of process that's happening?
It's the same. It's very similar chemistry. Again, there's a luciferin and a luciferase. The energetics are very similar. You're talking about the flashing light you would see in an ocean wave when it breaks.
Yes, but just one of those things in nature that gives a sense of real wonder.
Yes, this is the beauty of biology.
Professor Jay Dunlap. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker, and the producer was Rachel Wright. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.